Support for the full story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
Kids are under a lot of stress to succeed in school nowadays. Now, what kind of stress does that put on teachers and parents? And if that isn't enough, what if the school buildings aren't what they should be to help everyone succeed? The buildings. Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak, and a short time back, we had a program about a proposal in New York State. This was to give students mental health days, the idea being that kids get burnt out, and then how about giving them some time to recover? Now, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, and we weren't going to spend the whole show talking about stress and burnout, but we changed our plan slightly because there was a survey done by the CEA, the Connecticut Education Association, and that survey caught our eye. We're going to talk about the contents of that survey with Melanie Kolek, who's the legal counsel at the CEA. Hey, Melanie, how are you? Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for being with us. And also with us is Diane Fannis. Diane is a former teacher and is the president of the Stanford Education Association. Diane, thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Melanie, I'd like to start with you, if you don't mind. You surveyed, I believe it was around 1,200 teachers about their work environment?
Yes, we sent out a survey to our CEA local associations and received responses from teachers statewide, over 1,200, that indicated that they were having significant conditions in their classrooms, ranging from mold infestation, rodent droppings, venting issues, leaking windows, leaking roofs. And as a result of that, they were experiencing illnesses within their classrooms. And to some extent, their students were also suffering as well.
You know, some people are going to hear this and they're not going to believe it. They're going to say it's 2019. This is crazy. How can this be happening?
Well, there's a logical explanation as to why we think it's happening, and that reason being that many school districts, with the economic downturn and the decreasing enrollment, have slashed significantly their building renovation budgets. And now we are unfortunately seeing the consequences of doing so for repeated years. You know, schools have approximately 20 years when they're first built from needing any sort of significant renovation. And that's usually when the warranties on things like windows and roofs end up going as well. So it's not surprising that when districts put in new schools, rather, that they're not thinking strategically about the need for those things to be done over a period of time. And unfortunately, given this lack of upkeep, that's what we're experiencing today with the illnesses and the working conditions and the educational conditions that our students are experiencing.
Diane, now this survey looked at many school districts across the state, but you're going to talk about Stanford because you were a teacher there and you're now the president of the Stanford Education Association. How would you describe the physical shape of the school buildings?
Well, unfortunately, our school buildings are not in the best of shape right now. We have approximately 22 buildings, and more than half of them have serious problems and are in need of repair. Many of them are related to mold issues, but at the beginning of last school year, there was a major water intrusion issue, and the water intrusion was due to improper drainage at certain buildings, faulty skylights, improper caulking and sealants around windows, clogged gutters and drain pipes, and roofs that were leaking. And so on top of all of that and mold, there were structural issues and improperly functioning heating and air conditioning units. So unfortunately, our staff and students experienced poor ventilation and wide-ranging temperature and humidity levels. So that was at the beginning of the 2018 school year, and it was so severe in one school building, Westover School, that the school ended up being closed at the end of October, and staff and students were relocated to one of the office buildings in town. The owner of the office building quickly made it school-like so that the school could function there. And they've been there since October 2018. We're hoping that they'll return to their original facility once it's fixed. And the goal for that is September of 2020.
If you don't mind, I want to mention that the Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org, had a story about this the other day, and they had a comment from the superintendent of the Stamford schools, and I just want to read a short part of it. The comment says, "Unfortunately, we have had to identify and address issues that have either been ignored or gone unnoticed for decades. With the overwhelming support of our staff, all the Stamford boards, the mayor, our families, our community at large, we have made miraculous strides in a relatively short period of time. We acknowledge our work is far from completed. We will continue to work together to bring our facilities up to the same high standards as our educational offerings." So, Diane, it sounds as if they're trying to address the problem in Stamford. Is it that they're not moving fast enough for you?
Well, they had a facility study done in the year 2009 that indicated a lot of our buildings were in disrepair, and mold and water intrusion was even present at that time. And unfortunately, the city boards did not want to invest in correcting those issues at the time. So here we are 10 years later, and things got worse and worse as the years went on. Now, with the closure of Westover, the city established what they called a mold task force. And that task force began the process of figuring out how they were going to deal with the issues in the various locations. So, yes, they've been working on it, but it's a long process, and some of our buildings are in greater disrepair than others.
Melanie, what are parents telling you? And if this has been a problem for years, and obviously it took many years for it to get to this point, why are we just finding out about this now?
So parents have approached our association very concerned, wanting additional information, which we've obviously been directing them to the survey responses on our website, cea.org. Very concerned about sending their students to schools that might be making them ill. And I know that firsthand from a teacher perspective, as I have the privilege of representing our CEA teachers and workers' compensation matters. And it is alarming. It is, I have a lot of angry parents and a lot of frustrated teachers calling our office asking for assistance. And what we can tell them is that we are going to work very hard this year with our legislature trying to figure out the best way to approach it. And if you'll see in our survey that 40% of teachers reported to their school administrator that there was a condition in their classroom that was potentially harmful. And administrators apparently did not move on that concern that was raised to them. We want legislation passed that allows these administrators to know the particular process by which they should go through to report this. So while we are making the public aware, including parents, of the outstanding issues, we certainly are going to ask our legislature to implement a remedy and a process by which these conditions can be addressed so that administrators and teachers and parents know who to address these concerns to, and also to have a response from the school district to the community at large due to this community health issue about what is being done to address those issues.
Diane, I have about 2 minutes left in this segment, and my question for you to wrap it up is this another case of the poor school districts getting the shaft, if you will? Because let's be honest, are you going to be seeing any complaints or reports of problems from wealthier districts like what you're describing?
I really can't answer that for our wealthier districts. I know Stamford has allotted a significant amount of money to repair our buildings now that all of these issues have been identified.
Melanie, could I ask you to comment on that? Are you seeing more reports from districts that might need some more financial support?
I think for sure, but it's not across the board in terms of poorer or richer or larger or smaller districts. It's happening across the state regardless of the size or the financial ability of these school districts. We need, as I was saying, it's a community issue. We need the local, the state, and the federal government with these great grants that they have available to step in and assist on rectifying this very harmful situation that we have now for our students and teachers.
So you're seeing this from suburban districts as well as from inner city?
And rural.
And rural. It's all over the place.
It is.
Diane, any guesstimate as to when you think these problems will finally be fixed?
It depends on each of the individual locations. One of our high schools, the teachers there have been told that it possibly could take a year or two to correct all of the issues that are going on there. A main issue has to do with the heating and ventilation system, and that's something that cannot be worked on while anyone is present in the building, so work is postponed until the summer months in that case. Some of the schools that have a smaller amount of issues, the remediation is a lot quicker. I don't see the end in sight at this point. I think we're talking a long-term fix on all of our issues in all of our schools.
This is quite a story. Diane, Melanie, thank you. I appreciate you both coming on today. Best of luck
to you. Thank
you
very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Diane Fannis, who's the former teacher and the president of the Stanford Education Association, and Melanie Kolak, who's the legal counsel at the CEA, the Connecticut Education Association. If you would like to comment on today's program, we're talking about education, and we're going to be talking about stress for teachers and parents in just a moment from now. Well, if you want to comment, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, you can find us at Full Story WSHU, and you could always leave a comment there. And remember that all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the Full Story on Google Play or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. Our first break is coming up. We'll take that break, and we'll be right back. It's the Full Story on WSHU, and you can join in the conversation by leaving us a comment on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. If you're not on Facebook, send us an email, tfs@wshu.org. We are talking education today, and I'm going to head back now to what was originally on the docket, and that is stress for teachers, for parents, and basically how to cope with it nowadays. Because if you talk to some teachers, you will hear about what they go through and some of the stories. I can't tell them on the air. Some of them are unreal. And if you're a parent, and I heard this, believe it or not, three times in just the last 2 days, the stress of getting your kid just to keep up nowadays is a job and a half. I mean, forget the other stuff. Parents go through a ton. So we have a number of guests for the next two segments to talk about this. In the studio with me is Professor Donald Paris. Don is a Connecticut-based education consultant. Nice to meet you, sir. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Professor Judy Filaro is joining us on the line. Judy is an assistant teaching professor and director of special education programs at Quinnipiac University. Professor Filaro, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thank you for having me. I always enjoy this.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for being on with us. We love to have you here. Professor Paris, What kind of stress are teachers under nowadays? I mean, how bad is it? And is it worse than it was a few years ago?
I would say yes to everything, Ron. I notice in my travels throughout the state, there's an enormous amount of pressure, first, to help students perform academically. As you know, we have standards now for all learners. And I think, secondly, managing students' social and behavioral needs. And that seems to be increasing radically across the state. I've noticed many teachers I'm assigned to consult with are really struggling because they've had inadequate training at the university level, and they certainly need more expertise managing behavior.
Can I take it back just a little bit? You're saying the teachers have to manage social needs?
Yeah, they really do. You see in a lot of elementary schools in particular, they have all these displays on social-emotional learning, all these activities that are helping kids to develop skills like sharing, cooperating, being a good listener with others. It doesn't seem that parents have prepared their children for that kind of responsibility.
But that was exactly what I was getting to. Shouldn't that be something that the parents are teaching that begins at home?
Oh, absolutely. I think you can see a shift I would say from my experience, in about the last 10 or 15 years, everything we're discussing today seems to have made a radical jump since maybe early 2000s. And I'm not sure what the factors are other than it's society in general. And we have a lot of parents that are overwhelmed with the minutiae of being a parent, especially their economic responsibilities, managing their own personal lives. Mm. It seems like students are not quite as prepared to learn, if I had to generalize, in a lot of communities.
Professor Filaro, do potential teachers know what they're getting into when they decide to become a teacher? And does it matter? Because some teachers have told me, look, I had to do this. Teaching is in my blood.
Well, I think that teaching is the kind of thing that is in some people's blood. I know it's in mine. And for our students, both in our MAT program and then the students I have in my master's in special ed program, they're dedicated to the idea of teaching. But they do, as Professor Parrish was saying, they do need more help with behavior management. They also need help with taking care of themselves, yeah, because we're talking about teacher stress. There is a tremendous amount of stress today. One of the reasons that we started our master's in special ed program was because of inclusion, which is a great thing, but the problem a lot of teachers have with it is they don't feel adequately prepared. And part of that has to do with the state only requiring one course in special education for anyone who is becoming a teacher. And here at Quinnipiac, and I think Sacred Heart and Fairfield University of St. Joe's, all join us in thinking that that's just not enough for today's classroom. Mm. There's just so many children with different needs, coupled with the idea that there's a tremendous amount of anxiety. Nowadays, we're seeing in young children, and we're also seeing it in the college-age kids, and we're seeing it in teachers. And a lot of it has to do with all the violence that we're living through and the social media impact that, Professor Parrish was speaking about years ago and how different things may have been. And part of that is that we didn't have the tremendous influence of social media, which you almost can't escape. And I think that's added a layer of stress to everyone's lives.
I would say that's especially true at the middle and high school level. You see a huge amount of emphasis on social popularity, mm-hmm, kids wanting to be liked, in quotes. You'll sit in a high school classroom. Kids will literally be on their cell phone while the instruction is taking place. Mm. And if you're a 23-year-old person who just graduated, even if your intentions are good, if you've got an emotionally stable nature, you're going to be frustrated and stressed rather quickly. And that's just a minimal issue. Then you have kids with multiple learning requirements, mm-hmm, and I would say a huge increase in students who are not connected to the whole sense of school. At the elementary level, you'll see kids struggling with skills like lining up, waiting your turn, cooperating with a group activity, things that I think we took for granted 15, 20 years ago. Now a young teacher has to manage that while they're instructing.
And do you think this all goes back to social media, the advent of the smartphones and iPhones and everything associated with that?
I would totally agree. You can see a noticeable difference. And if you ask administrators who have been in their position for a while, that's almost the first thing they'll cite, especially again at the secondary level.
Professor Filaro, there is some from the younger generation. I mean, the big thing nowadays is for when those who are a little bit younger and they hear from boomers telling them, look, this wasn't done in our day, and kids behaved, they lined up, and they say, okay, boomer. I mean, that's their comeback. Are we possibly missing the boat here? Because it seems that when you talk with the young people, they're very comfortable with what they're doing, and they don't think that what they're doing is so strange. They think that we're strange because we don't do it.
Right on.
Well, I think if you think back, and, I do go back. I am one of the boomers. When we were, like, back in the 60s, we thought that we thought that what was being asked of us was strange, and that we weren't strange, and that was the whole beginning of rock and roll and, you know, all of that stuff. When we were growing up, we just didn't have this. You had the one phone maybe in the kitchen on the wall with a long cord, and if you weren't home, nobody could get you, and there weren't computers and all of that. Today's young people, right from almost birth, are being bombarded with visual input. And there's research that shows that all of this exposure to screens and to these different video games and all of this kind of thing is wiring the brains of these young people differently than ours were wired. So, yes, they feel like what's wrong with what we're doing because it's all that they know. We have, I guess, the vantage point, they might argue with that, of knowing what there was before and how simple it was and how, I think, much more easy to navigate it was. We didn't have as much as kids have today, but I think in many ways we were better off because we had to use our imaginations. We played outdoors, lots of things like that. We walked to school. We came home for lunch, all kinds of things that nowadays are just missing. And parents nowadays are working more than one job, so there's not as much family time. Or parents that don't work more than one job are trying to balance working, and a lot of the teachers are doing this, working and then having time for either themselves or for their families because their kids want to be involved in different activities. It's a different, really different world than it was maybe 30 years ago or more.
So I have about seven and a half minutes left in this segment, and I really want to talk about the effect that it's having on teachers and parents nowadays, because what you've both been describing, the parents and teachers are taking on so much more. And Professor Paris, as you said, the teachers are now social workers too, and they're dealing with kids' social needs. And we hear so much about the stress that they're under. So how should they cope? Because the dropout rate for teachers is significant.
Ron, I'd like to address that. These are recent statistics. Across the country, there's a shortage of 112,000 certified educators in the United States as we speak. If you walk into any community in our state, you'll notice there's a staggering number of teachers turning over, in quotes, burning out every year. I often consult with the youngest teachers in any particular point in time. They'll tell me, oh, I'm going to give this 2 or 3 years and I'll see if I can survive it. So they literally walk in with that mentality. Unfortunately, a lot of times they don't have coping skills and we get this constant cycle of turnovers. Bridgeport, Waterbury, New Britain, any place that has a huge student body, you're going to find that these districts are really pretty desperate to find replacement teachers, particularly in math, science, and special education.
Professor Falaro?
I would agree with everything he just said. What we've done here at Quinnipiac is, we've done a couple of different things. One of them is we have what we call a bridge program where we are reaching out to our graduates that are new teachers, and we're supporting them as they begin the process of getting used to, you know, having a class on their own and all the demands that that comes with. We also have recently started a social-emotional learning certificate that really took off, and the second course of it has to do with resilience for teachers, so helping them understand how important it is for them to take care of themselves and for them to be able to be present and mindful in what they're doing. The problem, too, I think, that we haven't touched on is that every time there's a budget issue, whether it's at the state level or within a district, the first thing that, to me, it seems, gets thrown out there is, well, maybe we can cut or we can lay off teachers, we can increase the class size. Right. So we have children that have more needs, and what people who aren't teachers are proposing is, well, it doesn't matter if they're in a smaller class. It doesn't matter if we have enough social workers or nurses or school psychologists. They can make do. And what we can do is save some money here by cutting this program or that program or cutting one of the classrooms in a grade. And I think if we ever did the experiment of starting off with kids, even in kindergarten, and saying, well, from K-4, we're going to have small classrooms and we're going to either have co-teaching or we're going to have well-prepared paraprofessionals in the room, there wouldn't be a need for dropout prevention or prisons later on, because those kids that have all of the different issues and needs, whether they're social or emotional, would be addressed. And they would be successful because they need that extra help. And we just are not acknowledging that. And I think teachers also don't feel valued. Mm. It's always a big, look what just happened in Chicago. The teachers were out in the streets again. I remember that from the 70s.
Mm.
You know, and when you have to go out in the street to be able to make a decent living, that gives you a clear message of how valued you are. And yet nobody would be anything without teachers.
Professor Paris, with the 3 minutes that we have left in this segment, if a teacher is listening to this and let's say they're a beginning teacher and they're within that 2 or 3 year trial period to see, is this really the career that I want to take? This is the dangerous time, the burnout time, the stressful time. How should they cope? What are the best things they can do?
One thing, I know it seems obvious, they have to have the confidence that they can respond to the needs of the students. A lot of the advice I give is when you stand in front of a class, you have to command yourself. You have to have this kind of inner sense of self-control, of confidence, those kinds of cliches. And I think some of the teachers don't quite have that maturity or that level of self-awareness.
Mm.
So a lot of the advice I'm even giving administrators is, don't just send teachers to workshops on instructional techniques and academia. It's way more important that the teacher's self gets attention. And I do think this is kind of ignored just because of the sheer stress of managing a learning environment. Imagine a high school. You might have 90 to 100 teachers. They're rarely going to get personalized feedback or attention. So I think that's one of the missing caveats in all of this conversation. And it's exactly what Professor Filario said. We need to really invest in that. And I also think the teachers have to have time to observe others and to get mentoring by a similar group so that they can have some shared experiences. Because quite honestly, it's a pretty lonely experience when you're in front of a group of students for 5 or 6 hours a day.
Yes, it is. Professor Filario, I know I only have you for another minute and a half. So what's your advice for the teachers? What's the best way to de-stress? Or is it just really that they need the experience?
No, I think it's a combination of things. And one of the things, I had jotted some notes down before the show started. One of the things I had jotted down was having common planning time, which we just touched on, the idea of having the time to collaborate with your colleagues and having time to visit a colleague and see how they're doing. We started off at one point with having a team that works with a new teacher, but I think all teachers need that time where they can sit down and not in the lunchroom or any of that, but just have common planning time. At one point in my career, I was a principal at Wovercross High School, and it was very difficult with the scheduling to try to give common planning time, and yet that was what people were craving. So I think that's one thing. I think seeking out things that are relaxing and having the time to try them, like taking long walks or trying yoga or looking into some of these new SEL courses that are out there because they're everywhere now, I think those are all important things. And also realizing that you have to have a balance. You have to be able to have a balance where you're devoting some time to your family, some time to yourself, some time to your work.
Professor Judy Filario is an assistant teaching professor and the director of special education programs at Quinnipiac University. Professor, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for being so generous with your time and coming on the air with us again.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I love to do the show with you, so I'm always available to you.
Excellent. Thank you, Professor. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Professor Donald Paris is staying with us. He's a Connecticut-based education consultant. He's going to be with us for our next segment, and we're going to be bringing in two other guests with us. And if you would like to join in the program, email us, tfs@wshu.org. Facebook, we're at Full Story WSHU. You can like us and comment right there. And remember that you can download the Full Story as a podcast. Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, we got them covered. Download it there. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. You're with the Full Story on WSHU. And as always, I thank you for listening and for being part of our discussion today. And if you want to join in the discussion, which I know is near and dear to the hearts of many of you, you can find us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. Don Paris is staying with us. He's an educational consultant. He's based here in Connecticut, and I'm going to bring in two guests who have been with us before, and they were kind enough to once again give us their time today. I'm going to start with Superintendent David Gamberg. He's the superintendent of South Hold and Greenport schools on Eastern Long Island. Superintendent Gamberg, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me, Ron. It's a pleasure.
Christopher Clouette is also with us. He's the superintendent of schools in Shelton, Connecticut. Superintendent Clouette, always a pleasure, sir. How are you?
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Could I start with you, please? The conversation the last few minutes has been about the stress and the strain that, you know, teachers and parents are experiencing nowadays. But this conversation today was inspired by that program we did recently about the call to have mental health days in New York State for students. How about we have them for teachers and parents?
Well, there's certainly a lot of stress in our society, and that's in the global society. I believe that the way to reduce stress is probably to work together to find activities, perhaps mindfulness, perhaps versions of mindfulness that allow for people to reduce the stress. I'm not sure that I support the proposal to have mental health days for students, as I've mentioned before, and the same I think applies to staff, but I do recognize the need to deal with the realities of stress.
Superintendent Gamberg, is the stress worse nowadays? I mean, how would you say it compares to, let's say, 10, 15 years ago? Or is maybe the stress just different because of the emphasis on getting ready for college at such an early age?
Oh, I think it's unquestionable that the stress has increased globally, as my colleague in Connecticut has pointed out. You know, I've been in education over 30 years, and I've personally and professionally witnessed the increasing stressors that come into the schoolhouse on a daily basis, both for students and for staff. And I also concur that I don't know if mental health days is the answer. I do think that there are structures and practices that we should adopt and policies at a state level that really need to regulate and balance out both the student and the staff experience, if you will.
Professor Paris, I've told this story before, but please stay with me because this is the first time I'm meeting you and you haven't heard it. When my kid was in grade school, and he must have been in the third or the fourth grade, I had a discussion outside the school one day with some parents about preparing the kids at that age for college, which I laughed at because I just thought that was ridiculous. This kid's in the third grade. You know, I'm having trouble remembering packing his lunch and he's having trouble remembering taking it. And they're talking about getting him ready for college. But for many of them, this was completely normal. And they were saying that I was the one who was out of the loop because this is just the way it is nowadays. Is this part of the stress factor here?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. It's interesting. There's a dichotomy. I've been in over 290 schools in Connecticut. In fact, one of which was in Shelton. It seems like we have a polarity. We have a number of students, increasing, by the way, that come to school lacking a lot of basics that prepare them to learn. For example, mastering language, learning social behaviors, as we kind of mentioned, just having the mindset that I'm here to learn and I'm ready to perform. Then we have the other extreme, I think more of what you just mentioned, where the kids are under constant pressure to perform, even at an age where you would not necessarily assume that that's critical to their long-term development. And if you look at the competitiveness of our society, yeah, I think some parents may have overextended their children's preparation for adulthood. You see, a lot of these kids are burnt out on sports, all kinds of after-school activities. They're trying to embellish their resumes in preparation for adulthood. I'm not so sure, though, the kids have that inner strength and that inner sense of self to develop that way, especially in a kind of linear format where you're moving year to year through the system.
So just let kids be kids, right?
Would make sense to me. if you go to a lot of schools, you can ask the teachers. Many of the kids don't play after school. They're not out and doing anything. It's kind of like spontaneous, if you'll pardon the term.
Right.
Addicted to technology, playing video games, talking on the phone. That's kind of consuming this generation, unfortunately.
Superintendent Gamberg, can I get you to comment on some news that just broke today? The Democratic presidential candidate, the U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, she put out a proposal today to lengthen school days 3 hours up to 10 hours. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I did catch wind of that. I concur with your other guest that just spoke about let kids be kids, or you said that. And, you know, I'm not so sure that adding time is necessarily going to be the solution. I understand the premise behind her proposal. To be in a supportive way. But I think ultimately the pressures that we have need to be addressed regardless of whether it's a 7-hour day or 8-hour day or 6-hour day. It's what we do within the time that we have. And if I may just go on a bit of a tangent, you know, I'm reminded of the notion that they tell you when you board an airplane, put your oxygen mask on first before helping others. And what I mean by that is when we want to have children function in a schoolhouse that is less stressful, that their teachers have to be less stressed. The children are watching, and it's something that we seem to miss in this race to somewhere to try to, you know, be more competitive. I think fundamentally it's a bad design of educational systems. Again, regardless of how long the day is, it's what we're doing within it. We're overcrowding them. There are too many administrative directives. Teachers are on initiative overload. There's the next best way to get to some new technological advance that they think is going to help them be more competitive. And in reality, we have to simplify things. We have to create a structure that attends to the humanity of what it means to teach and to learn in a school.
You know, Superintendent Clouette, this goes back to what you and I spoke about, it's probably a number of months ago now, in terms of the mental health issues that many teens and young adults are having nowadays. And you could see by the statistics the increase of freshmen and sophomore in college who are going to mental health professionals and saying, I have anxiety, I have depression, please give me some help.
Well, I think I'd like to respond in a couple of ways. One is just referencing back to Senator Harris's proposal. I think a 10-hour day, although I respect her, I think that's not the answer to the dilemma that we're facing that you just described. I think that the fact that the schools are constantly at the intersection of all aspects of society, so racial bias, the need to master new technologies, the need to learn the basics and create the future all at the same time is an example of overload, and adding 3 more hours to that is not necessarily the way to go.
Professor,
with that said, I think that part of what makes teachers so stressed out is the issue of knowing the importance of the work they do and the weight of co-creating the future with students. I mean, the weight of teachers who are co-parenting in a sense with parents to help co-create a future for the children they serve is a weight. And when Dr. I believe is Dr. Gamberg's comment about initiative overload, et cetera, I think it's a problem when we add more and more accountability measures and testing and ranking and rating to this work. It only causes teachers to be more stressed out, and to your point earlier, and students see that and feel that.
Professor Paris, would you mind, you showed me a very interesting paper during the break, and you had some statistics on there about teachers and burnouts and dropouts.
These are national statistics, 2017-18. About 8% of all teachers in the United States leave the profession annually. This is now the highest turnover rate in a study that was just done about 3 months ago. 33 to 40% of new teachers leave between 3 and 5 years upon employment. and it's costing our society upwards of $2 billion related to these issues. So those are staggering statistics.
Yes.
I would like to say one thing for the two gentlemen that are with us this afternoon, since they're superintendents. I'd like to have the audience visualize that you're walking into a group of students. Let's pick like sixth grade. You're dependent on them being motivated, having some kind of internal desire to perform, having some degree of self-regulation with their behavior, and also to be respectful toward authority. That's the whole concept of school in a quick summation. Let's argue that a teacher is not receiving that benefit from the students. This, I believe, multiplied over time, is what really erodes their ability. It changes their whole sense of their productivity. Administrators now have to be involved to help manage those crises. And you can see how this becomes a cycle, which is very difficult to manage.
Superintendent Gamberg, how big of a problem are overbearing parents in this issue? I have known some over the years, and I, from my perspective, they were not nice to the teachers, if you will, because they felt that their son or daughter was was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Sure.
What role should parents play here?
You know, it's a tricky thing. I think that there has been a shift and a change in the relationship between some parents and the institution of the school compared to the way it was 20, 30, 40 and so odd years ago, because the school was viewed and teachers were viewed. I think your previous guest talked about teachers don't feel valued. And we see that beyond just those parents that are maybe quote-unquote difficult. At the same time, it's extremely important to work in partnership with families. We have to bring families in as collaborators and not as adversaries. It's a challenging problem, and it's part of a societal problem. I think ultimately, as the professor described the synopsis of what school is, we have to build a strong foundation for everyone that's involved in this enterprise. It has to be joyful, and it pays dividends down the road. You know, we talk about children being able to play. I believe that we have to engage teachers in a playful part of their work. Hard work should also include playing with ideas, playing with the concepts that they're going to work with children with. It changes the dynamic from the accountability mentality and the ranking and the sorting into this collaborative space. If you look at highly effective private schools, I think you see that kind of atmosphere where the arts and music and celebration is rich and vibrant. And there's no reason why every schoolhouse from the inner city to rural America shouldn't have that same opportunity to create that type of environment.
Superintendent Clouet, I guess I'm having a little trouble trying to figure out which teachers are going to make it, because you know, from what Professor Paris was telling us, the dropout rate is pretty significant for the first 3 years or so. Do you look for a particular type of person with specific characteristics when you're recruiting?
Well, I do look for people, referencing the previous comment about joyfulness. I do look for someone that brings joy to the work as a part of it. But I think in terms of my work, trying to create teams of people that can support each other, there needs to be a level of not just self-care, but an opportunity for teams to work together to make sure that everyone's okay and to support each other as difficult situations arise. I do think this speaks to the issue of redesigning what we mean by school. I think the 19th century pattern that we still work within, where there are classrooms and you start in kindergarten and next year's first grade and second grade, et cetera, and then you have that isn't necessarily meeting the needs of kids who have their eyeballs on screens starting at age two and have the ability to click things on, off, move things, you know, check in, check out at their own speed, at their own rate. I think that that is an aspect of the stress that students are incorporating into their own selves and the impact that has on teachers. And it goes in both directions, of course, because many of the young teachers I'm hiring now come from that very same background. And so I think a redesign of school with the opportunity for project-based learning at the center and an opportunity in that context for a sense of playfulness and creativity and curiosity all would help.
I like to say something. I agree totally with both comments. It's difficult when you interview a teacher and or hire them at the same point to assess their what I call affective tendencies, their character, their kind of emotionality. Everything that I sense when I observe teachers, which is pretty constant, that might be the absolute tipping point between those that do become very effective and those that struggle. So in other words, in plain terms, people look similar on resumes. They often have a productive interview. People tend to, quote, like them on a personal level. But engaging students is a whole different dynamic. The kids are way more engaging in terms of defeating the experience that's in front of them, especially because of the technology. And I think a lot of teachers are baffled. They're a little surprised that they have this wealth of knowledge. They're prepared to present it, but the audience is less receptive. And the teachers who adapt are the ones that are going to be our most capable instructors over time.
I've got a feeling that we could do a whole show just on that, right? Personal dynamics and,
really
what, and what
There's
makes
no question.
That.
Absolutely right.
Because that's everything right there. It's what and but that's the secret sauce, isn't it?
Certainly
you know,
is.
Ron, it was actually I think Professor Paris would know. Chaim Ganat, I believe he was quoted as saying, "It's your personality that does the teaching."
Yes, you're correct.
Actually,
yep.
Right.
Yes.
And if I may be so bold, I'd like to just share part of a quote that he's famous for because I think it's very pertinent to the whole idea of teacher stress and how that impacts student learning. He was quoted as saying, "I've come to a frightening conclusion that I am the decisive element in the classroom. It's my personal approach that creates the climate, my daily mood that makes the weather. As a teacher, I possess a tremendous power to make a child's life miserable or joyous. I could be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration." Mm-hmm. And if you think about a stressful teacher, a teacher who's stressed, they're not going to be able to deliver that.
No.
Well, to add to that, I like the term that I've heard Mark Brackett use on several occasions, emotional labor.
Yes.
There's a lot of emotional labor involved in teaching, precisely to the point that your personality, you're always on, and your personality in many ways defines the chemistry of a room and the ability of, in many cases, for children to learn. With that said, people outside the profession don't see that. Everyone inside the profession knows how exhausting it is, and hears colleagues say how exhausting a day of work is day in and day out, even when it's exhilarating. People don't see the emotional labor aspect of it.
I've enjoyed the conversation today. I'm sorry it has to end. And gentlemen, thank you. This was enlightening and it was wonderful. Christopher Clouet is the superintendent of schools in Shelton, Connecticut. Superintendent Clouet, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ron.
David Gamberg is the superintendent of Southold and Greenport schools on Eastern Long Island. Superintendent Gamberg, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Same here. Thank you, Ron.
And Don Paris, how can people reach you? Connecticut Educational Consultant?
I'm on LinkedIn. Spell P-E-R-R-A-S. A little different.
Beautiful, Don Paris.
Thank you for having me.
Don Paris, thank you, Don. If you would like to comment on today's program, you could email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, you can find us right there at Full Story WSHU, and you can leave us a comment there. And remember, all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the Full Story on Stitcher, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. That's going to do it for our show today. Joelle Schrock is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is standing right there, and he's the producer. Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.